everybody. Welcome back to the First Assist podcast. I am your host, Taylor Goodstein, and I am joined this week by Dr. Matvey Tsivian. He is a urologic oncologist at the Medical University of South Carolina. He did his residency at Duke and then his fellowship at Mayo, and he is currently the director for the Urologic Oncology Fellowship at MUSC. His clinical interests are pretty broad, but he does focus on bladder, kidney, and testis cancer. So thank you so much for being here, Dr. Tsivian.
Thank you, Dr. Christine. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. And the topic that we are going to be talking about today is one that I heard you give a lecture on when you came to our Emory Advances course, which is about early cystectomy in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. Could you start by telling the audience, the listeners, what we mean by early cystectomy in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer?
Yeah, I think when I was making that talk, I had to invent this a little bit because if you look around, there's not a clear definition of it. So I think the way I looked at it, I said that we would call it early if it occurs before exhausting or even attempting any bladder sparing therapy, which is, I think that kind of definition could be applied both to non-muscle invasive and muscle invasive bladder cancer as well. So it's an early cystectomy before attempting any treatment to spare the bladder.
And I think that's a good point because now that we are developing more and more of these drugs, these bladder sparing drugs that are coming in on the market, now early cystectomy has a potential to be defined as after failing BCG, which like back, I think historically that was when you would do cystectomy and non-muscle invasive bladder cancer at baseline.
Yeah, absolutely. We are fortunate with all of the drug development, both of non-muscle invasive and muscle invasive, that we have a lot of options. And I do think that those advances will reduce the need for our services for those patients for radical surgery. But it also highlights the need to identify those patients who do need that.
Right, and the patients that are not going to be at risk of progressing while they're being treated with those drugs, definitely.
Absolutely.
And we'll talk a little bit more about biomarkers towards the end, but I wanted to just kind of start by explaining the reasoning why you would do early cystectomy in a patient.
Yeah, I think we all have seen those patients that bear those risk factors, those biological disease features that make it progress early. Either they're under stage, which is the limitations, highlights the difficulties in our staging and the limits of TURBT as a staging tool, or the biology of the disease is such that it is a more aggressive disease, and we may be fortunate to catch it in the window of opportunity where the disease is still in its curable stage rather than waiting and approaching it at a later date when the disease is advanced metastatic and not curable with modern techniques. I think those are the two categories there. So on one hand, understaging with limitations of our tools, and on the other hand, the need to identify those biologically aggressive disease variants that require more aggressive treatment rather than intravesical therapy.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Our staging, the tools that we have at our disposal are not perfect. Obviously, I think the main ones that we're using in the world of bladder cancer would be our TURBT, our EUA, and then our CT scans. Do you at any point get MRIs? I know there's the whole BI-RADS system that is a potential. Do you use that at all when you're considering who to maybe sign up for early cystectomy?
Yeah, I've seen the data about it. I don't use MRI on a routine basis, on an individual basis maybe, but I have not seen data compelling enough for me to rely on that rather than on pathology from TURBT. And I don't think there is a tremendous additional value in most cases over traditional CT staging with the TURBT and EUA.
Got it, got it. So when you have a patient that's coming into your office for a new diagnosis of, let's say it's high risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, when do you start talking to that patient about cystectomy?
Depends a little bit on the patient and on disease characteristics. I try to introduce that concept very early on. And this is because even with optimal intravesical therapy of non-muscle invasive disease, there still is a risk of progression that is not negligible. through our treatment. So I think it is beneficial for the patient to know where this road may lead. And it, I think, helps frame that conversation in what is the value proposition here to keep that surgery away, if you will. So I think these patients are willing to accept more of the morbidity of the intravesical treatments, knowing what is the benefit on the other side of it. Clearly, that conversation is more in depth, if you will, for a, say, high-grade T1 with CIS and LVI, rather than for a two foci of high-grade TA.
Right.
The risk profile is a little bit different between the two.
So you might have a longer conversation with that first patient and maybe kind of brush over it with the second as like, this is a potential, but maybe not get into the details as much.
Essentially, yes. We go over all the options there, but once again, in a lower risk, high risk patient, if you will, I think the conversation about surgery is a little bit less important than it is in a patient with multiple risk factors, mm-hmm. recurrence, and so on and so forth.
Now, speaking of specific patient characteristics, what about somebody coming to you with variant histology? You know, let's say micropapillary or sarcomatoid. Is this somebody that you completely skip intravesical therapy in and really strongly recommend going straight to cystectomy?
Yeah, I think this is a very interesting topic of subtype histology, subtype of variant histology, mainly because there are not a whole lot of data out there available for it. And it depends a little bit on who you read and also who reads the pathology. If the pathology is read with 5% of subtype histology, that's one thing, as opposed to it's predominantly squamous or it's predominantly sarcomatoid. I think this is where the individual characteristics of the tumor type with individual characteristics of that patient come to. This is where our job, I think, as consultants for those patients are more rewarding and more interesting because lack of data, but we do understand disease biology a little bit more and we're able to reason with the patient and guide them in their journey of bladder cancer. In more concrete terms, I think if there is a minor component of subtype histology, I would treat it like urothelial. But if the component is more important, I think this is where I would steer them a little bit more towards aggressive therapy, for the most part. Plasmacytoid and micropapillary, I'm a little bit more cautious with, but minute component of others, I'm willing to accept. Granted, all of them would probably need a re-resection for adequate staging. So that makes us feel a bit better about offering intravesical therapy rather than cystectomy.
That's actually perfectly leading into my next question, which was about repeat resection. If somebody is on board with early cystectomy and that's what they want to do, is that somebody that you would take for a re-resection before that, or would you just skip it and go straight to cystectomy?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think this point, the crux of the matter here is the poor quality of our staging, essentially.
Yeah.
So if I were confident that all there is high-grade T1 with LVI and CIS, say, then we don't need a repeat T or BT, right? But we do this because there's this 10%, give or take, of understaging and finding muscle-invasive disease. And if it is muscle-invasive disease, then by not offering them neoadjuvant therapy, pembro nowadays, but mm-hmm. we're not doing them a good service because that's not the optimal treatment for muscle invasive cancer nowadays in 2026. So I think that in most cases I would re-resect, and it's easy for me to say because most of those patients come to me as a second opinion. But if we were to imagine an optimal quality TURBT in the future, and I don't know how do we define it, done by yourself in your center with enhanced cystoscopy and there's muscle included and so on and so forth, would that be good enough to reduce that number of upstaging. I think if we get to that point, then we may omit TURBT. But this is also a conversation with the patient and their individual goals. If there is a large proportion of sarcomatoid, then maybe we do not need a repeat resection or squamous or adeno. That sarcomatoid, let's have that alone for a second. Let's leave that aside. But if it's predominantly adeno or predominantly squamous, for which neoadjuvant we're not exactly sure whether it works or not, I think in those few cases we may omit re-resection. Mm-hmm. But in most, I think we would still go for a resection.
So I think that's an important point, I think, for the listeners to touch on, like to rehash that. So if upstaging will change your management, meaning you're going to give neoadjuvant, then and you're unsure if you had a complete resection or you want to make extra sure, then yes, at repeat TUR. But in those subtypes that you're mentioning, adeno, sarcomatoid, squamous, where you might not necessarily even give neoadjuvant, the recommendation is to go straight to cystectomy, then knowing whether or not they are stage, you know, T1 versus T2 doesn't necessarily matter as much before cystectomy. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, I think so. Sarcomatoid, I'm not sure we should necessarily include that in the category of adeno and squamous, because there are some decent data for neoadjuvant for sarcomatoid, but by and large, what you said is absolutely correct. If it doesn't change what you do, why would you do that? I think it's important to emphasize that's why our guidelines say that for subtype ovarian histology, you should do a resection, and this is in order not to miss those aggressive variants, not to miss the understaged disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now speaking, so one other area I wanted to touch on was urothelial in the prostatic urethra. If that was a patient that maybe you pushed harder for upfront cystectomy rather than trying, you know, BCG or another intravesical therapy first.
Yeah, I think this is another area of a lot of uncertainty, in the sense that there are not clinical trials that included those patients with intravesical therapy due to a perception that that area is not bathed, if you will, by the intravesical therapy, right? We don't know if that's true. That has never been tested, so we don't know if that assumption is correct. And some people would do a TUR of a bladder neck, so and all kind of exciting things. I think that understaging in the prostatic urethra is more rare. This is not supported by data. This is just a hypothesis, if you will.
Okay, got it.
It's more rare than understaging in the bladder. And this is just because there's a lot of prostate and we all know how to do TURP. So it is easier to get a big, deep bite with prostatic stroma and everything in it. So I'm not as much worried about the understaging of disease. I'm more worried about residual disease or disease that is not adequately treated by intravesical therapy. So that conundrum results in a very interesting conversation with the patient, that where the main problem is not the disease but the location,
right?
And it comes down to mostly patient preference, but in some aggressive variants or again repeat high grade T1 or CIS. Or LVI, I do tend to steer them a little bit more towards aggressive management, mm-hmm. as an option for them.
Yeah, I think we've all been in that situation where we're doing TURPs with the purpose of like bathing the prostate in BCG, you know, like theoretically, yeah. We're opening it up so that we can get our drug, mm-hmm. delivered there. Whether or not it works, though, I mean, I guess that's anybody's guess. This is like another, I just think just having this conversation, I was thinking about our pretzel, you know, the pretzel, mm-hmm. you know, that's sitting in there and drug is coming out every time the patient urinates. Maybe that's a better option for something like prostatic disease. Again, this is just me spitballing here, but, you know, I was just thinking that, you know, that dilemma that we have.
Yeah, I think urothelial carcinoma of the prostatic urethra can be classified as an orphan disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it is, I don't expect any industry-sponsored trials in that space, and it's going to be investigator-initiated small things. This is why we will still have a job as reasonable people.
Right, yeah. Yeah, expert opinion, so to speak. So we've talked about variant disease. We've talked about prostatic urethral involvement. What about the patient who has BCG toxicity? The patient that does a couple doses of induction BCG and can't handle it, can't handle the symptoms. Is that somebody that you're going to be recommending early cystectomy to, or are you going to switch them to another drug?
Yeah, I think that we are once again in a great time for bladder cancer where BCG is not the only option. I think it is curious that we regard BCG as the mainstay of therapy. It's a drug that is over 100 years old. I don't see any other drug that is over 100 years old that we're still using in oncology nowadays. It's akin to Cooley's toxins. So I think if one does not tolerate BCG as a drug, we can switch to something different. That something different, I think, in most places would be gemcitabine docetaxel. And if the patient does not tolerate intravesical therapy, well, then that is a little bit of a different situation there. If they cannot hold, could we do off-label INLEXZO, for instance? Maybe we've done that. For instance, a transplant patient where you can't give BCG. And has trouble tolerating the catheter because of a kidney transplant. So
Oh, interesting.
small bladder. So would INLEXZO be something that's off label that we could use? Maybe. I don't think that intolerance of our method of administration or of the drug is per se would be a reason to push for early cystectomy. It's more disease biology, I think.
Okay, but because there are other things you could try, you could try symptom management. I think the EAU talks about quinolones, like giving quinolones at the same time and how that can sometimes help. So there are options, to help hopefully try to get patients through treatment. But that's a good point. One of the other things I wanted to talk about in this category, we've talked about some patient characteristics, some tumor characteristics for why we might do early cystectomy. But what about like, when a patient is looking at what the rest of their, what's the next year, 5 years of my life going to look like in terms of like, am I going to recur with this or that treatment? I think there is a very real positive for cystectomy potentially in terms of the disease-free survival space, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, it is important to look beyond the first year, but I think there's no doubt that extirpative surgery is highly effective for the treatment of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. It is a matter of morbidity and valuing this over intravesical therapy. CISTO trial has sort of answered that for us in the sense that I think the predominant thought process in the community, at the very least, and among some academic urologists too, that cystectomy is bad. It's terrible. It needs to be avoided at all cost. People say, well, he doesn't want a cystectomy. Well, nobody does. Nobody wants a cystectomy. But if we actually look where the rubber meets the road and do a trial like CISTO and look at the quality of life of patients who undergo intravesical therapy or bladder sparing versus extirpative surgery. Surprise, surprise, the quality of life is not that bad. It is not a good procedure, but again, the alternative is just as bad. So I think it is worthwhile looking at morbidity of repeated installations of repeated courses of intravesical therapy. I think we will be seeing more and more of those with the advances in pharmacology now, with the newer drugs. We're going to be operating like in every other disease after first, second, third line of treatment. Maybe not even for cancer, but for end-stage bladder.
So there's like that the other alternative option for patients that are tired of all the installations. Obviously now there's nadofaragene on the market, which is every 3 months, so that can provide some relief for patients that are tired of coming in for their their induction and their weekly, what, every 3 months, sort of thing. So in the BCG unresponsive space, obviously for now, but the cystectomy, once you get them over that initial hump of surgery, it comes with none of that sort of surveillance anymore, which can be attractive to patients who have been going through it for a while.
Absolutely. No, I think quality of life has to be considered in those patients. And And like you said, between its children and the other intravesical therapies, this is a lot of therapy. And toxicity is not only in side effects, albeit most of them are minor by our classification tools, but there's also financial toxicity associated with it.
Yeah. And that was something that the Cysto trial looked at specifically, you know, financial quality of life at a year, and found that cystectomy was better. Cystectomy was better than bladder sparing treatments in all metrics of quality of life, with the exception of sort of GI and sexual side effects, where it was worse. So that is, I think, an important trial for trainees to be aware of, so they know, like, they can counsel patients what, you know, again, patient-informed decision-making, what is important to you, like what is going to be most important moving forward in your life, you know, to help counsel them on these different treatments.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think there will be a time where we would see how many lines of treatment of intravesical therapy does it take before cystectomy.
Right. Yeah. Before somebody's
just... Children, now that's an interesting point too, and this is a little bit of a tangent. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
Speaking of it, children, I think we're going to be using this as a hey, do you need a break from once weekly?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. It is not the most effective drug by reported data, 24% at a year. But at the same time, hey, it's every 3 months. Do you need a break a little bit? And many patients after BCG unresponsive, and maybe they had another line, and they, yeah, I do need a break. And this is where Adstiladrin comes in. And that maybe gives them a little bit more of an energy boost to go with some more intravesical therapy afterwards before considering cystectomy, right? Those people that we can drag along, if you will, from one treatment to another.
Right. I'd imagine at MUSC, you have a lot of patients that come from far away, that you're, like, you know, dealing with patients that have, you know, maybe a few hours or couple 2 to 3 hours to drive to get there. And that's another, you know, patient population that I think is really going to love something like Adstiladrin.
Yeah, absolutely. This whole intravesical therapy should be, again, us in centers of excellence in our ivory towers, patient come here from some time away, and that's a lot of financial toxicity that is added to it. Wouldn't it be nice if we could go to them with the intravesical therapy at home BCG or at home Gem/Doce?
That would be. If have you looked into that? Are home healthcare centers willing to give that a go?
Well, Tim Lyon at Mayo Jacksonville, he was pioneering that there. And I think there was someone from UPenn that successfully did that too. I think the main barriers to it are financial barriers, where the institution is not sure how to support this financially because of different budgets, if you will. The societal economy is different from the health system economy.
Yeah. And I don't know a lot about the storage of these drugs. I think Adstiladrin has to be, like, defrosted a certain amount of time before being given. Like, I don't know about the other ones, if there's, like, something with storage that would make it difficult to, like, bring to other people in their homes.
Well, if we can travel with liquid nitrogen, I'm sure we can figure out a way to.
All right. You got me. Touche.
But no, you have all of the other things that are Pretzel, for instance. It's just on the shelf, right? It's not, it doesn't need any specific storage. Gem/Doce, same thing. BCG, you reconstitute it within an hour or two. So it's feasible. And for most of the intravesical therapy, I think Dr. Lyon at Mayo showed that it's feasible, proved that it's feasible. And UPenn folks showed that too. The question is not if it's feasible, but if it, can you create a program and can you sustain it? That's where the crux of the matter is.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is all very an important conversation that's circling around the idea of quality of life for patients. And I think we like to think that cystectomy is going to be the worst option for them in terms of quality of life. But when you look at these sort of day-to-day factors of what it takes for a patient to be on bladder sparing treatment, what it takes out of their weeks, to be driving back and forth to different hospitals to deal with the bladder side effects, now they have LUTs and they're waking up at night, to go to pee like 5, 6 times. I think there's a lot of different things that go into that might make it so that bladder sparing is maybe not as good from a quality of life perspective that I think we're starting to appreciate more and more.
Absolutely. I cannot agree more with you.
I do love talking about the cysto trial. I think that was a really great, great timing when that came out. It was right before a lot of these new bladder sparing drugs kind of hit the market or were starting to get become, FDA approved. And they're now I was they're doing another arm of it where they're looking at like adding the new bladder sparing, it's Adstiladrin, Nogependican, like all that stuff. And so it'll be interesting to see. I'd expect that financial quality of life thing is going to go even further in the direction in favor of cystectomy.
No doubt.
So speaking of staging, we were talking a little bit about how staging is something that we struggle with, getting adequate, accurate staging for these patients, and that be a reason in favor of early cystectomy because there's a certain number that upstage. How do you see things like ctDNA and UTDNA playing a role of like maybe making you more confident in your staging, less confident in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer specifically, which it hasn't had a lot of headway in yet, but I think it's not unreasonable to start considering it for that.
Yeah, I think it's in the pipeline. We've had some data with UTDNA from Niagara that was in muscle invasive, but you can sort of extrapolate it. I think anything that we can do to make our staging tools better, whether it's enhancing the quality of TURBT, whether it's using adjunct markers beyond just simple histology morphology of the tumor. There are molecular markers that we could use. Right now, the data is not sufficient, I think, for prime time for clinical use, but I think we're getting there. We're hopefully getting there, to a point where aside from the clinical characteristics of that tumor and morphology of that disease, we'll have something else that measures the disease in a different way, or measures the aggressiveness of the disease in a different way, whether it's urinary DNA, ctDNA, whether it's molecular profiling, whether it's markers, any of the stains that you name it, there's 10 papers a day of those. But it is clear that we need something more than just the TURBT as it is now, because even in the optimal TURBT, we still have understaging, so we still are not as good as we want to be. I'm not sure if there's a particular one of them that you prefer, or you would put your money on that horse, whether it's a UTDNA or ctDNA or which one that is. To me, it makes sense that UTDNA would be, because it's closer to the tumor. But when we're talking about systemic disease or risk of progression, then maybe ctDNA has value too, because not only local disease measurement, but systemic disease measurement. Not ready for prime time, but it is exciting times. It is exciting times. ctDNA, I think there are a couple of publications, one from Cleveland, there's another one from New York, I believe, evaluating the use for ctDNA. It's a pretty good marker for ruling out bad disease. But we also need to rule in bad disease. So I think there's a lot to be done there still.
And that's, I think there's a lot of ctDNA work in muscle invasive and in, metastatic bladder cancer, but in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, I think, what you're saying, there's been a couple of studies, a couple of people have looked at it, but it hasn't been as well established. And I do agree with UTDNA, you'd think that that would be better because non-muscle in disease by definition is not as, like systemically, it's not as like deep into the wall of the bladder necessarily connected to the bloodstream. So you'd expect there to be a little bit more, likelihood of finding residual disease with urinary tumor DNA rather than circulating tumor DNA.
Yeah, I think it is possible to plausible for us to surmise that UTDNA may be may be useful to predicting residual disease or recurrent disease, whereas ctDNA may signify something a little different,
more aggressive,
different level of biological aggressiveness. Yes.
Yeah, understaging.
And not every ctDNA is the same. So it depends on what you do there, tumor-informed, not tumor-informed, which gene panel are you choosing exactly. Remains to be seen. And if we combine this with say, variant histology at the same time, then we have a whole pile of uncertainty.
Right. We're just adding complexity to the pot, like always. Yeah. Be careful what questions you ask, because you'll end up with 50 more.
Right.
Are you using any sort of like AI pathomics when you're currently kind of, you know, staging patients, determining their risk factors or risk groups?
For high risk disease, we do use predictive tools, AI based predictive tools for BCG versus gem dose assignment. Valar Labs, shout out to them. There are others, but that's the one in primary use right now, just because those are the primary tools that we have for high risk tone muscle invasive disease for intravesical therapy. So that does guide our choice between gem dosi versus BCG.
Yeah, and just so listeners know, that's an AI-based sort of pathology review. They like just send them one of the H&E stains of the tumor that has already been examined by the pathologist, just gets sent to the lab and it gets scanned, and the AI looks at it and determines if the patient is better served by giving BCG or gemdosi, and they do that with like a high degree of certainty or high degree of being able to tell the difference there. Did I nail that, or did I oversimplify?
No, it's spot on. It will tell you if the patient is more likely to have a good response from gemdosi rather than it doesn't matter. So,
right,
it can direct patients more towards one treatment than the other. So, predictive tool rather than prognostic.
One other tricky area I wanted to make sure we talked about is older patients. Obviously, bladder cancer is a disease of older patients. The EAU is a little bit more aggressive about recommending cystectomy, early cystectomy, for their like very high risk subgroup. And one of those clinical risk factors that could potentially make a patient very high risk is if they're older than 70. So the older the patient, the more high risk, according to EAU, which would maybe push them towards cystectomy. That's also, though, the patient that you're a little bit potentially more worried about, like getting through a big surgery. So how do you balance that age question when you're thinking about early cystectomy in patients?
Yeah, I'm going to use the old cliche, age is just a number, right? But I will also correct it and say, yes, but it's still a number. Under anesthesia, everybody behaves their age, more or less.
Right.
Age is a factor. There's no doubt about it. I think we often equate age with comorbidities, and they do often come hand in hand, but it's a separate variable. Age is age. Would be nice if we operated all the time on healthy people who are young, but most young and healthy people don't need our services, thank God. I mean, it is what it is at the end of the day, and it's an individual discussion with the patient regarding their individualized risks of surgery and the benefits of surgery. I don't think I ever refused somebody surgery just based on their age. Operated well into the 90s, maybe even 100, but that by in it within itself, age is a consideration, but it is not a variable with which there's a cutoff. After this age, no, it's prohibitive. And this brings me to we can also limit the morbidity of surgery. If we look at extirpative surgery that we're talking about from 30 years ago, it's not the same as today. Between the better anesthesia technique, regional anesthesia, between the early mobility feeding, all the various ERAS protocols, and the enteric and faster surgery and robotics and all of the above, that limits morbidity of of surgery. And this is probably in part why Sisto trial was surprising to some. It's still a morbid surgery. It still carries mortality, a certain percentage. It's real. It's not a walk in the park. But at the same time, all in all, I think it is not as morbid as it's often led to believe that it is. It is not a terrible surgery. Mm-hmm. I wish we would never do them, but at the same time, they're necessary, and age in and of itself is not a limiting factor.
I think there's something also to be said about patient counseling. You know, we've talked a little bit about that in terms of counseling them for bladder sparing treatments. I like you said early, when a patient is coming in and their new diagnosis, you talk about cystectomy. And I always like to throw in there, I'm like, look, like if this ever becomes just too much, like the bladder sparing, that the constant, the symptoms that you're dealing with, the waking up at night to pee, the constantly coming in to get surveyed, you know, the cystectomy is always there as an option. And then if that option gets chosen and now they're on the road and they're getting cystectomy, telling them what to expect, you know, having a very, you know, a long conversation before surgery of what it's going to look like during their recovery period. When are they going to start feeling like themselves again? Like how important it is for them to walk, how important it is for them to get off of opioids early, to drink a lot of fluids, you know, that sort of counseling, I think, goes a long way at improving the morbidity in patients if they kind of know what to expect.
Absolutely. I think preoperative counseling, I think this is part of the reason why prehab programs are successful. It's not necessarily the interventions of prehab, I don't think. Don't shoot me on the spot, but it's more of the counseling. They have more time to explore the idea and know how it's going to be, and there are no unknowns. Everything is regimented. They know exactly what's going to happen. Meeting with the ostomy nurses prior and going over things and going on Beacon and looking at videos with people with an ileal conduit versus neobladder. All of these things, I think preparation is key here. And a lot of it, of this is on us, right? Not only to counsel them, but also to give them resources that they can rehash things, that can learn more things. And Beacon has been instrumental for my patients. I think that is absolutely the key to a fast recovery. It's knowing what to expect and knowing how things are going to proceed in a normal way. Yes, get out of bed early. Let's get at them. No opioids. Everything's going to be fine. We're going to support you. Bad things happen. We'll fix it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you have any patients that you use to talk to other patients, like patient advocates that have gone through the surgery that are willing to have those conversations and have been kind of champions of helping other people get through it?
Yeah, there are a couple. Actually, I chose those that things did not go smoothly. So that they can, when they talk to other patients, their experience is not rainbows and unicorns. They've had complications. They have experienced what a course is like that is not smooth. I think that is, I think it is important. I think it's important to not understate this procedure too, because it is morbid. And most of my patients are prepared that complications from the surgery are expected almost. And I don't think any course is, or it is rare to have a perfectly smooth course. Something minor, most of the times, gets right in the way.
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned at one point about, you know, our centers of excellence for bladder sparing, but there's something to be said also for centers of excellence for cystectomy and how to prepare patients for outcomes. Is that something that you talk to patients about explicitly, or is that just something that you're thinking in the back of your head? You know, morbidity is going to be different depending on where you get this surgery done.
Yeah, I think, yes, I do. I think we have solid data to say that surgeon experience and institution experience or volume can be correlated with surgical outcomes. I think that If there is a physician out there in rural somewhere that doesn't have access to anybody else and is doing cystectomies and it does one a year, I don't think their outcomes are going to be as good as the outcomes of Emory or of MUSC, where there's not a whole lot of things that we haven't seen and don't know how to manage. And this goes through not only surgeons, which are faster and more agile with things, but also pre-op care and post-op care. Everything is regimented. Everything is according to a pathway. Nothing is unusual. And that is important. That is important for better outcomes, I think, and for recovery. So, yes, it's absolutely paramount, I think, to concentrate these surgeries in centers of high volume that dedicate themselves to it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the nursing thing cannot be understated, like having excellent post-op nursing, having an operating room team that knows what to do. I mean, that really can't be understated in the outcomes for these patients. Wound as well, you know, a trained kind of wound ostomy. Do you have, this is completely unrelated, but does your wound ostomy team pre-mark patients in the pre-op area before the operation, or do they do that like ahead of time, like in their own clinic, or do they do that at all?
Oh, you had a can of worms and you opened it. All right. That's good.
Oh no.
So I'm in the process, long and protracted battle here for expanding our wound and ostomy nurses pool. They're understaffed. They are not able to provide consistent and good outpatient services. They're very limited in what they can do outpatient time-wise. And given that the patients for the most part are from far away, I think the average here is about 2.5 hours or so, it is not feasible for us to do an outpatient visit before surgery with the ostomy nurses for every patient. So the way that there are wonderful ostomy nurses get around this a little bit is they do a phone call before surgery. In the week leading to surgery, they call the patient and go over things over the phone and provide them resources and email them resources that they can use. They're marked in pre-op the day of surgery, and our ostomy nurses are following them inpatient and virtually post-op as well. But yeah, I wish that and I'm working on it, and hopefully I'll make some breakthroughs here that we can hire some more ostomy nurses and have a more robust outpatient presence.
I mean, this is one of those facets that goes into the whole gamut that is cystectomy care, right? Like there's all these different elements that have to be considered in order to get patients those good outcomes that we want them to have.
Yeah, we can start with that, go into prehab, nutrition, exercise. So all of these things, and then we say, oh, those are fantastic interventions. They all work. It's great. Okay, how do you apply it to a patient who is 3 hours away?
Yeah.
And that is a whole another dimension of challenges in taking care of those patients. And then on top of that, you apply some social difficulties for those patients who are elderly, often need support, often not from the highest socioeconomic classes. It is challenging. I know how you guys do things. I do rely heavily on our GU nurse navigators, which help me a lot of times manage those problems that are not directly medical, directly oncological, but how to get the patient to an appointment, how to get them back from the appointment to home because somebody might have dropped them off.
yeah.
So those things are a whole another dimension that highlights the need for this multidisciplinary care that in less experienced places, let's say, or lesser volume places, may be lacking.
Well, we're almost at the end of the hour. We've spent a lot of time talking about early cystectomy, who to consider it in, and as well as some other topics as well. We haven't even broken into the area, I think, of muscle invasive disease, especially there. That's becoming, I think, a little bit more of an interesting conversation with EV Pembro, neoadjuvant EV Pembro. All this is to say, my question is the cystectomy going to become obsolete in the muscle invasive space? We've got EV Pembro that's doing a lot of good work for us. In the non-muscle invasive space, we've got all these new bladder sparing options that are coming down the pipeline or already out there. So is this going to become an operation of the past?
I think I hope that the role of cystectomy is going to become less prominent. I hope that with the newer treatments and with better patient selection, we can spare some patients this surgery. At this point, I don't think we can safely do it in many cases, but I think cystectomy is going to remain there. I think it's going to be it will be around. It's just going to morph a little bit. It's going to morph a little bit into you doing it after multiple lines of therapy, or you have those very accurate biomarkers, or you improve your TURBT to a point where you're very confident with your disease biology classification, if you will, where you know there's a window of opportunity and you strike at that moment. I think the role is going to evolve just as a hammer for every nail to something a little bit more refined, even in more advanced bladder cancer, right? Metastatic bladder cancer, metastatic urothelial. I think there's a whole lot to be said there for consolidation after modern treatments, right? I think that unfortunately, with the multiple lines of intravesical therapy, we will be seeing more bladder cripples, where cystectomy is going to be used not because of oncologic considerations, but because of functional considerations. So I think it's just going to change a little bit, and we'll have to adapt to those changes and pioneer, and it's on us to define the role and to expand the access to it, right? And to figure out a way, how do we offer the best treatment for a person who is 3 hours away? That's on us. That's not on them.
Well, we started talking about early cystectomy and then we just started talking about like the philosophy of cancer care,
Yeah.
which I think is like a great place to end. Was there anything else that you wanted to say to trainees about this topic or any topic, I guess, in when it comes to bladder cancer, since we've kind of branched out a little bit?
Yeah, I think if I would have to profess something here from this podium is that the world of bladder cancer is changing, and it's changing rapidly. But us as professionals, we have to be on top of things, number one, and it's challenging in bladder cancer nowadays. But we have to be well versed in all these data here and well versed in surgical approaches so that we are able to offer all of those options to our patients and be able to have a reasonable conversation with colleagues like we are having, but also patients and guide them through that journey there. So those are exciting times, also challenging, but that's okay. Challenge is good. Challenge is how we learn, how we evolve.
I think one of the quotes that I remember hearing when it was like I was trying to I was never really like seriously trying to decide between MIS fellowship and oncology. I was always oncology, but there was something I heard that really cemented it, which was, fall in love with the question, not the technology, because the technology is going to change, right? Just give it a few more years and we're going to get something new down the pipeline. But if you're really focused on the question, the cancer, the biology, then you're always going to have something to think about, something to contribute to the conversation.
Yeah, I think in the same line, I think the phrase that I used a couple of times when the arguments come to technology or robotic or open, decisions are more important than incisions. So yeah, and decisions are more difficult.
Well, anyway, thank you so much, Dr. Sivian. This has been a great episode. I think, people are going to learn a lot listening to this, and I can't thank you enough for coming on this podcast and chatting with me.
Thank you, Dr. Christine. It was a true pleasure.